Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Bio 241. It's April 17th. We've got the schedule projected on the screen. That's as bright as I can get those projectors. So you might want to, this one's a little bit brighter. Maybe that's why everybody's sitting over here. I'm not sure. Okay. Well, maybe that light bulb will burn out completely, and then we'll get it replaced. But if you have a comment regarding the projectors, for me or my boss or media department, go ahead and put it in the sign-in sheet and I'll pass the words on for you, because I know sometimes it's really hard to see those slides because it's a little dim. All right, so I think last time you had a test. Yeah, you had exam 3 last time, and they're graded. They're in Blackboard. If you want to see your exam, highly recommended that you come by office hours and take a look at your exam, okay, because you probably pick up stuff. Maybe some of you are unsure whether or not you should go back over the test and erase answers that you put down, because sometimes you erase the right answer, put the wrong answer down. But so you got to come back and look and see if you're the kind of person that catches mistakes or if you undo good answers. You just have to make up your mind. I was the kind of person that caught mistakes, so it was worthwhile for me to go back over my test. Probably that's the way most people are. Okay. Okay, so our next test is going to be May 8th, so we got to get started on that because we should be on heart and circulation today, but we're just going to be starting muscle. All right, so muscle is kind of a nice review because where have you had muscles before? Anatomy, that's right, you've had a lot of muscles already in anatomy. So that's where we stand. Your grades are in Blackboard. I'm also putting your lab grades into Blackboard over the weekend. I put the most current information, but since then I got even more current information from lab instructors, and I'll keep updating it so you know exactly where you stand. Okay? All right, so does anybody have any questions at all? Questions at all? All right. Are we going to make it through all this stuff? More than likely. More than likely. I don't know how it's going to happen exactly, but it usually happens. Okay? Okay, so like in this chapter right here, it says structure of muscle, skeletal muscle. Well, gee whiz, you know, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time talking about structure of muscle because it's just a review. But remember that a muscle to bone connection is called a tendon, and that's dense, regular, connective tissue. All right, and surrounding the whole muscle is some fascia, and there is more connective tissue, okay, that we call the epimysium. And then a muscle like this, maybe nice biceps muscle right here, is broken down into fascicles, just bundles of cells. Right, so a fascicle is a bundle of cells, and they're in their own connective tissue sheath. Right, and each one of these fascicles then are made up of individual muscle cells. And these muscle cells that I see drawn in right here, okay, have other structures on the inside that are really long and tubular, and these are the organelles of contraction. These are the myofibrils. All right, so you should know the hierarchy of how muscle is put together and all these different connective tissue layers around the muscle cell, the fascicle, and the whole muscle. And all of these connective tissue sheaths join together to form this tendon right here, which then inserts into this bone. So all these things fuse together, so that when a muscle cell contracts, it pulls on that connective tissue sheath, which then pulls on the outer connective tissue layer, which then pulls on all the connective tissues of muscle, which then produces tension on this bone right here, and basically it moves a couple of bones closer together. Okay, so right here is an individual muscle cell, and this is a little strange, I suppose, because you see many nuclei within a single skeletal muscle. And that's because during development, this fiber right here could have been 100 or maybe 1,000 individual discrete muscle cells, progenitor muscle cells, that fuse together to form this long tubular structure that we call a muscle fiber. So a muscle fiber and a muscle cell in a mature person are exactly the same thing, all right, even though a muscle fiber or a muscle cell is multinucleate. So that's something interesting about a skeletal muscle cell. There aren't many cells that are multinucleate, but there are some cells in your body that don't have a nucleus. Does anybody know of a cell in your body that doesn't have a nucleus? It is alive, and that is an erythrocyte or red blood cell, and we got to get to talking about those sometime really soon. Okay. The other thing that I see on this slide right here, besides these myofibrils, but there's some other fine structures inside every myofibril, and we call these filaments, and we're going to actually look at a lot of different filaments today and how they operate inside of a cell. The other thing I notice when I look at the skeletal muscle cell is that there is a repeating pattern over and over and over again. And when you look at skeletal muscle and cardiac muscle underneath a microscope, it looks like a structure that we call striations. So it produces striations when we look underneath a light microscope because of this repeated pattern of proteins that make up skeletal muscle as well as cardiac muscle. And that's the internal machinery for contraction. So that should tell you that cardiac muscle and skeletal muscle is very similar on the inside in terms of how it contracts because the proteins are kind of similar. So here I see those striations. All right, so here is a muscle fiber, just a long filamentous fiber, and it's loaded with myofibrils, and it just so happens that all the proteins that cause contraction in all those myofibrils line up perfectly with each other from one myofibril to another. So it produces that nice striation or striated appearance instead of just a homogeneous structure. Okay, the neuromuscular junction is what we're going to really look at first. So here we have a somatic motor neuron coming from the spinal cord all the way to a skeletal muscle. And remember, it only takes one neuron to get from the central nervous system all the way to a voluntary effector organ. And how many different kinds of voluntary effector organs are there in the body?
One.
There's only one, and that is? Skeletal muscle. That's right. As a matter of fact, of everything that is controlled in your body, there's only one thing that you have voluntary control of, and that is skeletal muscle. Everything else is controlled autonomically through the autonomic nervous system. So here is a voluntary, sometimes we call this a somatic motor neuron, and it goes all the way to a muscle fiber. So here is the outer membrane of a muscle fiber that we call the sarcolemma. So anytime you hear that term sarco, you should think of skeletal muscle. Like anytime you hear the word osteo, you should think of bone. Or if you hear a word hepato or hepatic, you should think of liver. Okay? So various kinds of keywords. And chondro would be cartilage, for instance. Okay? Anytime that sarco you hear, then you should just think automatically of skeletal muscle. So here is the sarcolemma. That's the plasma membrane of a skeletal muscle cell. And inside we see all the myofibrils, and then we even see some fine structure inside the myofibrils that we're going to get to in just a minute. All right, notice that this axon terminus right here is highly branched, and it's very large. It's larger than most synaptic endings on an axon terminus. Okay, and each of these processes right here are loaded with synaptic vesicles. So this neuromuscular junction is huge compared to most synapses between neurons within the nervous system. All right, the neurotransmitter that's contained in these synaptic vesicles right here is acetylcholine, and that is true 100% of the time. I don't think anybody's ever discovered another kind of neurotransmitter for a voluntary system. Okay, and of course there's mitochondria in here because it requires a lot of energy or a lot of ATP. So when an action potential reaches this axon terminus through the usual kinds of mechanisms, these synaptic vesicles migrate over to the presynaptic membrane, fuse to the membrane, and release neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft right here. And so you can just use your understanding of any kind of typical chemical synapse to understand how this neuromuscular junction actually works. It's very much the same, right, with the following exception that I alluded to just a second ago, and that is that this synaptic ending is huge compared to most synaptic or synapses in the nervous system. Right, so there's much more acetylcholine being released on this skeletal muscle cell. The other thing is, once this skeletal muscle cell is excited, which is a characteristic of skeletal muscle or any kind of muscle, it is excitable. Right, what happens to this cell right here when it is excited? It contracts, right? It moves. It probably pulls away from this motor neuron right here, which then means you would lose control of that skeletal muscle. So there are additional features of the neuromuscular junction that attach it to the cell membrane right here so that it doesn't move when the muscle contracts, right? Neuron-neuron synapses don't have to worry about that particular condition because neurons don't move to that same extent. Okay. So we have these folds. So we call this area right here the motor end plate, because it attaches these axon terminals to the skeletal muscle fiber so that they can't be pulled apart. And these things are huge. You can look at them underneath the microscope. This probably right here is maybe about 200 power. I can't see for sure what it is, but these are very large structures. You don't need a lot of magnification to see them. All right, so acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter released. So there are receptors for acetylcholine in the motor end plate right here. So there are ligand-gated channels, and it's a nicotinic-type receptor, so it's got to bind two acetylcholine molecules. And then what happens to that ligand-gated channel when it binds acetylcholine? It's not shown on this slide, but from other chapters, you should probably know what's happening. What's happening? Okay, it opens up a channel. It opens up a gate. So that sodium moves from outside the cell to inside the cell, and what does that produce? Yeah, that's excitation, right? So that produces a depolarization event that produces a graded potential. Now, here's another interesting thing about the neuromuscular junction. Also, in the motor end plate, there are not only ligand-gated channels, which can be stimulated by acetylcholine, but right in this area, there are also voltage-gated channels, which is not something that you've seen in the nervous system, right? Because in the nervous system, where are voltage-gated channels placed in a neuron? Only in the axon, right? So graded potentials have to travel all the way from a dendrite over the cell body to the axon hillock before they run into a voltage-gated channel, okay? And because those graded potentials can mix on the cell body, then that excitatory signal may or may not produce an action potential on a neuron at the axon hillock. So a neuron can make up its own mind whether it's going to pass that information on or not. But a skeletal muscle fiber, because there are voltage-gated channels right within the neuromuscular junction, can never make up its own mind whether it's going to contract. As soon as there is an excitatory signal on the axon terminus right here, there is enough acetylcholine released to open up the ligand-gated channels, which always causes a threshold voltage on the voltage-gated channels in the neuromuscular junction, which produces an action potential. And then what happens to that action potential? Since the whole cell membrane has voltage-gated channels, that action potential travels over the whole muscle fiber, and it excites the whole muscle fiber. So a skeletal muscle fiber can never make up its own mind whether it's going to contract or not. Whenever there's a signal for contraction, skeletal muscle just automatically always obeys because of the voltage-gated channels right in the motor end plate. Okay, and a skeletal muscle fiber, just like an action potential, is an all or none response. The contraction of this muscle cell is also going to be an all or none response. It's going to contract with 100% of its ability to do so. Okay, all of these myofibrils are going to shorten as a result. Okay, so every muscle, when it's told to contract, produces a maximal contraction, right? But for instance, when you use a biceps muscle, right, can you produce a graded contraction in this biceps muscle? Can you lift up something really heavy or something that's very light, like a feather, without smacking yourself in the face? You can. And how could you explain something like that? Because, yeah, it all depends on how many of the muscle cells or muscle fibers, right, you recruit to pick up that particular weight. So if you're picking up a feather, you're only going to use a few muscle fibers. All right, but if it's a really something that's heavy, like a bowling ball or a car battery or something, then right, all the muscle fibers in that muscle will contract to pick up a heavier weight. Okay, but there is some feedback. We'll look at some feedback to make sure that your motion is smooth and continuous and appropriate. All right, there might be times where you kind of trick yourself. Maybe you've been at a restaurant someplace, and everybody at the table asks for water, and they come over to the table with a big glass pitcher of water, and they put these big glass mugs down on the table, right, and they fill the glass mugs up with water, and you're thirsty, so you decide to take a sip of water, and you grab this big glass mug, and you lift it up, and it starts like flying off the table. Why is that? Because it wasn't made out of glass. Somebody tricked you. It was made out of plastic that's really, really light, okay? But all of a sudden, right, your cerebellum realizes something strange is happening, and it corrects your motion right away So there are sensors in your arm that we're going to talk about at the end of this chapter that then will cause the relaxation of some of these muscle fibers or the contraction of antagonistic muscles so that you don't lose control of your arm. Okay, so here we have two motor neurons. Right, so these are somatic motor neurons because they're going to skeletal muscle. And we can get down to the axon terminus right here and we can see a number of branches. All right, so we have two motor neurons. That means that we see two motor units on this particular diagram. And when an action potential runs down this motor neuron, all of these muscle fibers that are connected to this motor neuron will contract to 100% of their ability. And then over here, none of these will contract, of course, unless there is another action potential coming down this second neuron, in which case then these muscle fibers will contract as well, okay? And the ones in the middle won't. All right, so this is what we call a motor unit. It is one motor neuron and the muscle fibers that are connected to it via these neuromuscular junctions right here. And there's something called an innervation ratio, which is the number of motor neurons, which is always going to be one, right, compared to the number of muscle fibers that that one motor neuron innervates. All right, so if you want to have fine control in your body, like I see right here, right, the innervation ratio will be 1 to 3 because I only see 3 skeletal muscle fibers here that are going to contract. Okay, and that's going to produce a relatively weak contraction compared to this motor unit right here that I see has maybe 10 or maybe about 10 muscle fibers connected to it. So this motor unit will produce a strong contraction. This one will produce a weaker contraction. And in areas of your body where you want to have fine discriminative control, right, you have a very high innervation ratio, right? So just a few muscle fibers right here will contract, like for instance on your hand or your face. But postural muscles, for instance in your back, well, where there's one motor neuron right here, then there are going to be many nerve fibers that will be stimulated at the same time when an action potential comes down this one motor neuron. All right, so depending on the part of the body, the innervation ratio is different depending on the type of control. And then, for instance, there's another consideration that you should be aware of. When you perceive an object to be moved or a motion that you want to undertake, okay, that requires a lot of force, all right, then not one motor unit is used, then other motor units are going to be recruited to do more work or lift a heavier object. All right, so we call that recruitment to explain why a muscle like the biceps right here can undergo graded contractions or produce various kinds of tension even if a single muscle fiber can only contract maximally. So a whole muscle doesn't have to contract maximally, but every single fiber of that muscle, once it's stimulated, will. Okay, so that's a motor unit. So and we talked about recruitment right here. But don't forget, every individual muscle fiber produces a contraction in an all or none type of phenomena, sort of like an action potential. Okay, let's look at, we'll review some things from anatomy right here. So here's a muscle fiber, and I see a couple nuclei right here. So here's the sarcolemma on the outside. And what kind of membrane proteins do we have in the sarcolemma? Right here, everywhere where I'm placing the cursor. Because this muscle fiber is a lot like a neuron, especially an axon of a neuron. What's similar on a skeletal muscle cell and an axon in terms of these membrane proteins right here? It has voltage-gated channels, right? So a muscle fiber can propagate an action potential just like an axon. And what about an action potential far away from the neuromuscular junction compared to an action potential right at the neuromuscular junction? What's the difference between them? Absolutely nothing, right? So an action potential will flow over the sarcolemma without decrement, just like an action potential down an axon, okay? But it can only, an action potential is dependent on having voltage-gated channels, right, that are located on the sarcolemma right here. All right, the organelle for contraction are these myofibrils. So here's a myofibril with that repeated pattern over and over and over again. Other organelles inside this muscle fiber would be like mitochondria. It should be loaded with mitochondria. and sarcoplasmic reticulum, and some of these things I don't see. All right, but the point of this slide right here is to show that there's even some fine structure inside the myofibril, and we're going to call these filaments or myofilaments and learn something about the names of these myofilaments right here. This repeated pattern from this very narrow dark line and this very narrow dark line right here, that defines what we call a sarcomere. All right, so if you hear sarcomere, what are you going to be thinking of? Muscle, right, because of sarco. All right, so the sarcomere is the structural and functional unit of contraction in skeletal muscle. So this is the object that we really want to be paying attention to right here. Like, what is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells called? The synapse, right? And that synapse has got all these little different pieces like the vesicles and the presynaptic membrane and the postsynaptic membrane. And what does the postsynaptic membrane have so that the presynaptic cell can communicate with it? It's got receptors for the neurotransmitter, for instance, okay? All right, so use that model to understand something about how a muscle cell contracts, because all of these sarcomeres are going to contract together, right? And even all the sarcomeres and all the different myofilaments are going to contract together because they're all contained within this one single skeletal muscle cell. All right, so let's take a nice electron micrograph of a skeletal muscle, and we can now see some of the fine structure of these repeated patterns, which we call striations. All right, so there's a dark band right here. It's also called the A band, and that's really easy to remember because what's the vowel in dark? A. So it's really easy to remember. That's not how it was named, okay? But it was named because of how it bent certain kinds of light, all right? But the dark band and the A band is exactly the same. It's loaded with a protein that we call myosin, and if we look at the illustration down over here, that myosin molecule, right, doesn't extend from end to end of the sarcomere, but it's right stuck right in the middle, and it's very thick, so it blocks a lot of light, right? It blocks the transmission of electrons and light, so it looks dark. Okay, then we see some light bands right here on either side of the endpoint of a sarcomere. So here's the endpoint of a sarcomere right here. Then I see a light area. It has some proteins, some filamentous proteins, and it's not myosin, it's actin. And it looks light right here because the actin molecule is relatively thin. And people talk about these filaments as either being the thin filament or the thick filament interchangeably with actin and myosin. Okay? And the actin molecule is attached securely to the endpoint of the sarcomere. And what's the last letter of the alphabet? Z, right? So that's the endpoint of a sarcomere right there. Probably it's called the Z disc, not because it really has a zigzag structure right here. It is does on this illustration, okay? But probably because it's the endpoint of the sarcomere. And here's the other Z disc over here. So a Z disc and a Z line are exactly the same kind of thing, right? So on this picture, it just looks like a line, but if we were actually going to contemplate what a myofibril really looks like, it's a three-dimensional structure, so it's really a cap or a plate at the end of a sarcomere, a round plate, right? And that would be a disc. So a Z-line or a Z-disc are the same thing depending on what kind of artwork you use to display a sarcomere. All right, so here is an I-band, and that's really easy to remember. It's an I-band because it's light and the vowel and light is I, so it matches up. It's not too much gymnastics to remember that one. All right, then there's also an M line right here produced by some proteins that anchor the myosin filaments in position, right? And that M line is not really hard to remember because it was just named after because it's just a line right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. Then we have an area right here that's not quite as dark as all the other regions in the A band because there's no overlap between actin and myosin in this region. And that region is what we call the H zone. All right, so on this diagram is pretty cool because we see most of the proteins involved in a sarcomere except for one. Maybe that's on the next slide. But from this one, you should at least see two of the important kinds of protein molecules, the actin that are attached to the endpoints and myosin, which is attached to the middle of the sarcomere. And notice that they are not touching each other on this particular illustration. Let me look at the next one. I'm going to show you this one because I see the third kind of protein filament, and it is attached to both the Z-disc and the myosin molecule, and it is a titin filament. What can you tell me? What if you look at that structure of that titin filament, what does it look like? It kind of looks like a spring. And indeed, that's really what its function is. It's really not involved with producing tension or contraction in a muscle, right? It just produces some elasticity within the sarcomere. So that means muscles can stretch out, and then after you stretch a muscle and let go, what's going to happen to it? It's going to go back to its original position. Okay, so for instance, let's consider the biceps and its antagonist, which is the triceps. Okay, so for instance, when I contract the biceps, what has to happen to the triceps in order for me to flex my forearm? It has to stretch, right? Okay, and then when I extend my forearm like that, just let it go back, I'm not really contracting any muscles, what happens to my triceps right here? It goes back to its original length because of the titin molecules right within these sarcomeres. So there is a lot of elasticity in skeletal muscle fibers. So those are the three proteins that you should be aware of. All right, we've got actin, we've got myosin, and this titin molecule right here. All right, so when a muscle contracts, these Z-discs are going to get closer together. They're going to approximate each other. So something in here has got to shorten. Let me see if I can go back to the previous slide here a little bit. So I'm going to pose a question to you before I describe some of these things. All right, my intellectual question, my curiosity is, well, since this sarcomere is going to shorten, I'm wondering which one of these proteins here actually shortens in order to get this sarcomere to shorten. All right, is it going to be this actin molecule, myosin in the middle, but not the titin because I already told you it's not involved with contraction. It just has some elastic properties. Okay, so there is an association between actin and myosin right here. This is just a two-dimensional picture. But if we just make a three-dimensional illustration of what a sarcomere looks like, we can see all of the filaments kind of surrounding each other. And if we have a nice transverse section and make an electron micrograph like we see right over here, okay, I can see a myofibril very nice and another myofibril right here with some sarcoplasmic reticulum between them, probably some mitochondria in various places. But let's focus on the thick and thin filaments within the myofibril. And we can see the thick filaments right here because they are big dots in this representation. Here's another one, and here's another one. Okay, and the thin filaments are represented by these really small dots. That's the actin molecule. What can you tell me about this arrangement, right, with myosin here and actin? What does that kind of look like? Every myosin molecule is what? It's surrounded by actin filaments just because of the geometry within the sarcomere, right? And every actin molecule is surrounded by myosin filaments. They surround each other. So no matter where you look, if you're a myosin, you're going to find actin, right? And if you're an actin, you're going to look and you're going to see myosin someplace very close and next to you. So this is an important three-dimensional view that you should be aware of. Okay, so what do we have to talk about on this slide? The definition of the sarcomere is from Z-line to Z-line, right? Which is half of an I-band over here and half of an I-band over here. Okay, and then the A band represents everywhere where we find a myosin molecule. There's a little bit of a lighter area in the middle of the A band. We call that the H zone because there is no overlap between actin and myosin. Okay, and then here's that M line right smack in the middle due to these proteins that anchor the myosin filament within the sarcomere. So these I've been calling filaments. We could have just as easily called these things myofilaments. Right, and these are the kind of the smallest structures in terms of organization that you should be aware of. So you have a muscle. A muscle can be broken down into fascicles. And what's the building block of a fascicle? A muscle cell or a muscle fiber. Okay, and then what you need to build a muscle fiber? You need myofibrils. Okay, and then what do you need to make a myofibril? Myofilaments, right? So maybe have that little hierarchical organization in your mind, and let's go back the other way. If we have a bunch of myofilaments right here, what can we make? A myofibril. And if we put a bunch of myofibrils together, we can get a muscle fiber. We put a bunch of muscle fibers together, we can get a fascicle, and put a bunch of fascicles together, finally we have a muscle. Okay, yeah. All right, so that's the nice structure that you should be aware of. All right, so how does that sarcomere contract? Okay, my question was, which one of those proteins actually shortens? Okay, and here is a part of an answer to that question. A muscle contracts because the myofibrils, right, get shorter. That's the organelle for contraction. That's that big, long organelle that goes from one end of the muscle fiber to the other, from one end of the muscle cell to the other. So that whole myofibril contracts. All right, and it's not because of a particular protein that gets shorter or contracts. It's because those long filaments slide over each other. And we call this the sliding filament theory of contraction. And this is a nice loaded term, right, because it's used all the time inappropriately in everyday life. What the heck is a theory? It's something you can count on. All right, so it's not something that anybody's making up to make the class really hard or difficult to understand. This concept is not too hard to understand, but a theory is something that has been proven by a lot of scientific evidence by a lot of different laboratories all over the world, and everybody believes it, okay? All right, so the filaments, the thick filaments and thin filaments slide over each other, and when they slide over each other, then the distance between the opposite ends of the sarcomere, or the Z-discs, get closer together as a result. Okay, so we could take a bunch of real-world pictures of a skeletal muscle under different states of contraction with an electron microscope, and we have three different pictures right here, and on each of these pictures we can clearly see the Z lines or the Z discs very easily. All right, the top picture is when the muscle is relaxed, and we see all the basic structures within the sarcomere that we are familiar with, like the I-band here, and the A-band, and then the M-line, right, in the H-zone, just typically as we would expect. And then we can get the muscle to contract a little bit and take another electron micrograph of it, all right, and we can see, what about the distance between these Z-lines right here? Okay, they're a little bit shorter, so this sarcomere is indeed contracting. But now let's compare the A-band. Okay, the distance of the A-band, or the length of the A-band from the top to this middle picture right here, what could you tell me? It's the same, which means that the thick filaments have the same length. They haven't contracted at all. But the I-band is a little bit shorter. Okay? All right, so let's just keep that in the back of our mind. The I-band seems to be disappearing just a little bit. Now let's get this muscle to contract all the way, maximal contraction. So we see that indeed this third picture, the Z-discs are pulled together, okay? And now the I-bands have disappeared altogether, and we only have an A-band left, all right? Which means then that the myosin filament has not shortened at all, and then we see a little bit of a darker area right here, which then means that the actin filaments actually get pulled into this region right here that we call the H-zone. So the H-zone disappeared and the I-bands disappeared right here. All right, so let's look at an artist's understanding or depiction of what happened. All right, so here's a sarcomere when the muscle is relaxed. When it starts to contract, notice that the length of this myosin is exactly the same as in the relaxed muscle, and the length of the actin protein is exactly the same. Right, but the H zone is disappearing and the I zone, I band is disappearing. And then in the fully contracted muscle, right, the H band is completely disappeared and the I band is almost completely gone, because now the whole sarcomere just shows overlap between myosin and actin. So these filaments are just sliding over each other. So the length of this actin on the bottom picture is exactly the same length of the actin in the top picture right here. You could go home and measure that with a ruler if you wanted to, if it's not so obvious, because maybe some illusion is playing a trick on your eyes, but it's not really, right? And the myosin is exactly the same length in all three pictures. The actin is exactly the same length in all three pictures, right? But these proteins right here are just telescoping past each other, right? Like in the model of when you only had a telescope that you could fold up and then slide out, right, to take a look around. So we have these couple markers right here. They're both the same color, unfortunately, at least to my eye. One has a blue band on it. Okay, so we could say actin and myosin molecule. The question would be, and these make up a sarcomere, when a sarcomere contracts, which ones of these markers, okay, actually shortens? So my hands will be the Z-discs.
Right, so Z discs are going to come closer together. Which one of these proteins is going to get shorter to allow my hand to get closer together? That doesn't have to happen, because what can happen? These things can just slide over each other. And in Blackboard, there's some really nice video animations that show the sliding of these filaments. I don't want to take time in lecture to do that, though. All right, so look into Blackboard to actually see how these things slide over each other. So that is what we call the sliding filament theory of contraction. So none of the proteins actually have to shorten. All right, so this right here is just a table which summarizes everything that we've talked about so far. So I don't really want to read that to you in class. All right, well, let's see how the filaments slide over each other. So let's zoom in to an interaction between the actin and myosin filaments. So we're going to have to learn a little bit more about some of the structures of the actin and myosin myofilaments. First, let's look at this the thick filament, or myosin. It has some burrs sticking out of it right here, some processes sticking off the protein. All right, so these are what we're going to call cross bridges, because these things can, at certain times, associate with the actin molecule. It can actually form a bridge. And a cross bridge has a tail piece right here that allows it to extend up away from the myosin molecule. It's got a head piece right here, a myosin head piece, and the head piece has got some other interesting structures. It has an enzyme right here, which is an ATPase, which means that there is a binding site for ATP on this enzyme. So here's the active site that can bind ATP. What good is ATP? Yeah, it's an energy source, right? It can donate energy to a reaction that is thermodynamically unfavorable to allow it to happen. Okay, and that's on the myosin head. There's another part on the myosin head, which is an actin binding site. So I see a couple actin binding sites right here. Okay, which under proper circumstances can reach up and bind to actin molecule. All right, so it looks like a little dome right here. So that means that there is an actin binding, there is a myosin binding site on the actin molecule. It's got to be what? Complementary to the shape of this actin binding site on the myosin head group right here. So if this is a nice spherical structure, if the actin binding site on myosin is spherical, then there's going to be a nice spherical dimple, for instance, on the actin molecule to accept this head group right here. Or if this was triangular shape, then there's got to be what? Like a cone shape depression in the actin molecule to accept this binding site, right? So we always explain binding to an active site by what? Structural relationships of something, like lock and key model. Okay. So that's what we see. We see a nice ATP molecule right here. Let's describe this actin molecule. And the basic actin molecule has two long filaments that are made up of these balls, and they kind of look blue, but they're not ATP. They look a lot like this one right here. Hopefully they're a different color. Oh, good, they're a different color to you guys. Wonderful. So these are what we call G-actins, or globular actins, that are all just chained together like a chain. They're linked together, and they're kind of twisted around each other, so there's two of them. So that's really the actin molecule that we're familiar with in those illustrations. But there's some other components here as well. Two other molecules you should be aware of. There's another long molecule that runs along every filament of actin, and this is what we call tropomyosin. And right now, tropomyosin is covering up the binding sites for the myosin head group. Okay, so it can lie right on top of the binding site for the myosin head group. And then associated with tropomyosin is a molecule that we call troponin. And troponin is a lot like a molecule that we've looked at already called calmodulin. They're cousin molecules. What can you tell me about calmodulin? It binds calcium. There's an active site on calmodulin that can bind calcium. It just has the right shape. The same thing for troponin. It has a binding site for calcium. And when calcium binds, that's like poking you in the side, it's going to change conformation, right? Troponin is going to change conformation, which then will cause a change in conformation of the tropomyosin molecule. And you're going to see then that tropomyosin gets out of the way so that myosin can actually bind to a binding site that otherwise would be normally covered up on the actin molecule. Okay, so you should know troponin, which is like calmodulin. Tropomyosin covers up the binding sites. But these things can change conformation, whether calcium is bound to troponin or not. All right. The other thing that you notice about the myosin cross bridge is that it can change conformation as well. Here we see it in a nice crooked conformation. Let me just call it a flexed conformation. Maybe use a model of your upper appendage. Okay. So here would be like the elbow in your upper appendage. Here would be the forearm. Here is your arm right here. So in this particular condition, it's in a flexed condition. All right. And when it binds ATP and hydrolyzes ATP, it will change this conformation so that it's now in a nice extended conformation. When it's in an extended conformation, it can go ahead and bind to the actin molecule. All right. So where did the energy come from to get to this extended conformation right here? From the hydrolysis of ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate. Okay. Now, when myosin binds to the actin molecule, nothing is sliding, even though you have this arrow right here. The arrow just means a difference in time on this diagram. There's nothing really sliding. All right, it's just the hydrolysis of ATP allowed myosin to attach itself to this actin molecule. All right. Now, how is it that these filaments really slide over each other? So this is where we left off on the previous slide, right? Here we have hydrolyzed ATP, which is what? ADP and inorganic phosphate. The cross bridge is in extended form. It's bound to the actin molecule. And now, when inorganic phosphate, or PI, that's what that little I right here represents, just a free inorganic phosphate, a PO4 group, dissociates from the myosin head group. Okay, again, that's like poking you in the side. That's going to change the conformation change in the cross bridge till it goes back to its flexed condition like this. And when it moves back to its flexed condition like this, right, it's going to pull the filament over the myosin filament because it's attached to it. So we call this the power stroke. When inorganic phosphate is released from the head group, that's where that stored energy from ATP is released to pull actin over the myosin filament. And they slide over each other. And when actin and myosin slide over each other, because the myosin is firmly attached to the middle of the sarcomere and the actin is firmly attached to the ends of the sarcomere, guess what happens? The ends of the sarcomere get pulled closer together, or the Z-discs get pulled closer together. All right, so this is a pretty good description of the power stroke. Okay, and there might be some discussion as exactly when the power stroke happens, but for this class, just say when inorganic phosphate is released, that's when the myosin cross bridge undergoes the power stroke and the filaments start to slide over each other. So on this slide right here, we see the whole sequence of events of the sliding filament mechanism starting right here in a resting fiber. Okay, I don't see ATP. I see ADP and inorganic phosphate, which means that this cross bridge is in a nice extended form, right? And now it is able to associate with actin if the proper conditions exist. So it can bind to actin, right? Which we see in this particular case. It reaches up and binds to actin. Tropomyosin in this particular case, not shown on the illustration, is out of the way, right? And then when inorganic phosphate is released, what happens to this cross bridge? It flexes, let's use that terminology, okay? And that produces the power stroke right here so that the actin is pulled over the myosin filament, okay? All right, so the power stroke happens when inorganic phosphate is released. All right, now here we have myosin still attached to the actin molecule, which means that that sarcomere is in a shortened state. Okay, and the only way to get this myosin head group to release from actin in order to cause that muscle to relax is if another ATP molecule can bind to the ATP binding site right here. All right, and what kind of cells can make ATP? They got to have mitochondria. What does mitochondria need? Good oxygen and glucose and things like that. So what about a cell that's dead? Can't make ATP. If a cell that's dead can't make ATP, what happens to this myosin head group and actin? It cannot release, right? So a muscle cell that's dead and that is contracted, right, because there's no ATP left, right, the muscles are going to remain contracted, and that's what we call rigor mortis, right? So that explains why a person that has been dead for, or a body that has been deceased for, a certain period of time that has used up all the ATP in muscles is in rigor because the muscles can't relax because the myosin head group is like permanently attached to the actin filaments right here. Those skeletal muscles can't relax because all the ATP is used up. But if this is a nice healthy muscle cell, there is ATP that's being produced. Once it binds, then there's dissociation of the myosin head group from the actin molecule, and that leads us to this condition right here. All right, then the last step, since this is an ATPase, since the myosin head group has an ATPase, it can utilize the energy in ATP to produce a conformation change to extend the head group once again. And once it's extended, what can happen? It can rebind to the actin molecule, and this process will happen thousands and thousands of times every second on this cross bridge right here, but not just this one cross bridge, but with all the thousands of cross bridges between an actin molecule and a myosin, but not just in this one dimension, but what? Completely circling that actin molecule through the whole length of that filament within the sarcomere. And don't forget, all the sarcomeres are being activated together at the same time. All right, so that produces a tremendous amount of tension. All right, so how do we control contraction? We look at the energetics or the relationship between actin and myosin a little bit. Let's look at the control of the contraction once again. So here are those G-actin proteins that make the actin filaments, right? And on top of that is the tropomyosin molecule, and here is the troponin complex. And we said, remember, there is an active site for binding calcium on the troponin molecule. All right, so how are you going to remember that the small molecules are troponin, which bind calcium, and troponin is this big, long filamentous protein that covers up the myosin binding sites? How are you going to not get confused between troponin and tropomyosin? Yeah, tropomyosin covers the binding sites for myosin, but the big molecule right here is the big word right here. That's one way that I kind of remember it. I know I teach you guys a lot of really stupid things, but that's how I remember it sometimes. Tropomyosin is the big long molecule, and the short word right here are these little short molecules, right, that bind calcium. Okay, so unless you want to go back into the literature and see how these things were named, that's not too important in this class. All right, so this is controlled by calcium, right? Where is calcium normally high in a living body? Is it intracellular or extracellular? It's extracellular, so you shouldn't have any calcium floating around inside the cytosol, or maybe right micromolar concentrations, which is basically zero. So when calcium concentration is really low, like in the normal case, there's no calcium bound to troponin, tropomyosin covers up the binding sites right here. And contraction cannot take place because there can be no cross bridges that form. All right, so in order for cross bridge cycling and cross bridges to take place, there has to be an infusion of calcium around this filament right here. All right, so when calcium levels increase, okay, this is what happens. This is during rest. We see that the cross bridge right here is in an extended form, and indeed, I don't see any ATP. I see that ATP has already been hydrolyzed, right, that caused this conformation change. And so now it's able to bind to this binding site, but on this illustration right here, tropomyosin is in the way because there's no calcium bound to troponin. So it's covering up the binding site, so cross bridges can't cycle, even though ATP might be available for it to happen. Okay, but when the calcium signal is produced inside the cell, now I see a lot of calcium right here, it binds to the binding site, it makes tropomyosin move out of the way, then the myosin head group can bind to the myosin binding site on actin, and when PI is released, it's going to cause flexing of this cross bridge, and it's going to pull the actin molecule over the myosin molecule right here. All right, so calcium is the signaling molecule that allows for this cross bridge to develop, right? And before the cross bridge can even form to the actin, this myosin head group has to be in an extended form, so that the only thing that remains to take place is the release of inorganic phosphate right here, causing that's what we call the power stroke, exactly. So calcium is necessary to make these filaments slide over each other because the cross bridge can't form otherwise. All right, so let's look at calcium control of contraction. So here we have a nice skeletal muscle cell, and indeed I see some nice myofibrils. These are the organelles for contraction, and indeed I can see sarcomeres inside each of these myofibrils, and they all line up perfectly with each other. So when you look underneath a light or electron microscope, you see those nice striations. Right, so those are some of the organelles. I also see many nuclei. I see many mitochondria, because what does a sliding filament mechanism need in order to work? ATP, right? So a lot of mitochondria. All right, and then here is endoplasmic reticulum. And I see filaments, right, or tubes, small tubes of the sarcoplasmic reticulum surrounding every myofibril inside the cell. Okay, I don't want you to call these myofilaments filaments, because there are myofilaments inside the myofibrils you might be confused with, right? But there are tubes of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And what kind of sarcoplasmic reticulum does this look like to you? How many kinds do you know of? Two, you know? Rough and smooth. What does this look like? This looks like smooth. What are the functions of smooth ER, as far as you know? It makes lipids, and it also can store calcium. Hopefully I remembered to tell you that, because in that chapter of the book didn't have that. But hopefully I remembered to tell you way back in chapter one or two or whatever. Okay. So there is a lot of calcium, high concentrations of calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is really not in the cytosol, but it's sequestered in this organelle. So it can't have an effect on actin and myosin in these myofilaments right here. All right. So it's really an extracellular source. And it is released with certain kinds of signals. Okay, and let's look at the signal that can trigger the release of calcium from what we call the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Okay, what kind of protein did we say covers every square inch of the sarcolemma, which is the cell membrane? A special membrane protein that allows for certain activity, just like an axon, which was what? Was a voltage-gated channel. So that means that the sarcolemma right here can transmit action potentials, right? It's not going to jump down due to saltatory conduction, right? It's just continuously conducted via all those voltage-gated channels. And now we're interested, how do we get that action potential, which is trapped on the surface of the cell, right, deep into the cell right here to cause contraction of all these myofibrils? And that's because there are extensions of the cell membrane, or the sarcolemma, that deviate deep down and go everywhere to the interior of the cell. And we call these T-tubules, because they are, what is their orientation compared to the length of this fiber? Are they longitudinal? No, they're transverse to it, right? And a T-tubule just means a nice transverse tubule. So here is the opening of a transverse tubule that's just like a straw or a membrane of the sarcolemma that goes down deep inside the cell. And there are certainly proteins in this membrane right here which are voltage-gated channels, which then carry action potentials to the interior of the cell. Now that's a significant difference compared to neurons. An axon doesn't have T-tubules. The action potential stays on the surface of the cell. But a muscle cell has voltage-gated channels in these T-tubules, which carries that excitatory signal everywhere to the interior of the cell. Okay. The sarcoplasmic reticulum has a couple different structures involved with it. Lining or abutting the transverse tubule right here, this part of the sarcoplasmic reticulum we call the terminal cisternae. Okay, and the terminal cisternae are associated with the T-tubule. And most of the calcium is contained in the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. The other thing that I notice right here is that here's a terminal cisternae of an SR, then we have a transverse tubule, and then another terminal cisternae right next to it. Sometimes this group of three structures is what we call a triad, right? And it is involved in the release of calcium so that cross bridges can cycle. And when cross bridges cycle, what happens to this myofibril right here? It shortens, right, and produces tension. All right, so this is the triad, and then here are the different structures in the myofibril. So here we see a nice neuromuscular junction. This illustration is maybe a little bit strange, okay, because I see an axon, a somatic motor neuron, coming in, and I see a bifurcation here and a bifurcation here, but remember that there's only one neuromuscular junction on a muscle fiber. There aren't like three. There's only one point on that whole muscle fiber where there's a neuromuscular junction. Right? So there aren't really three. A muscle can't be excited in three different locations, only in one location. So that's kind of a strange depiction right here. Okay. So here are the synaptic vesicles. And remember that there are special attachments between the axon terminus and the skeletal muscle cell so that the skeletal muscle can't pull away from the somatic motor neuron. And in the neuromuscular junction, this is the motor end plate right here, we see a number of different membrane proteins. And I think this one right here, because it forms a nice dimer, this is probably the nicotinic acetylcholine ligand-gated channel. Right here, so it's going to bind acetylcholine from the somatic motor neuron. So sodium, predominantly the effect is going to be sodium entering the cell, which is excitatory, a nice depolarization signal. But also in this area, and unlike neurons, here is a voltage-gated channel, right? So that when there's depolarization from the ligand-gated channel, this produces what? Immediately, without question, can never make up its own mind. Okay, it's gonna cause the opening of this voltage-gated channel, right? And that's gonna produce an action potential because all these voltage-gated channels are gonna then open up to at the same time. So it's a nice positive feedback mechanism. And since there are voltage-gated channels everywhere on the sarcolemma, what's gonna happen to that action potential? It's gonna flow over the whole muscle cell, including down into the T-tubules right here. Right, so an action potential goes down to the interior of the cell. Another thing that neurons don't do, but a skeletal muscle cell does. Okay, now there are special other kinds of channels that line the transverse tubule that we see right here. There are voltage-gated calcium channels. So if there's high calcium outside the cell, calcium will then enter the cytosol. Okay, and then there are sarcoplasmic reticulum calcium release channels. All right, so these right here are triggered by voltage. They will change conformation. And notice they're coupled to the calcium channels within the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So that when these change conformation, because there's a change in voltage due to that action potential coming down, it will automatically pull open like a door on this one right here to allow calcium out. All right, so we call this one right here electrical mechanical coupled receptor, right? And that one is the this one here is the DHP receptor that's coupled to this one right here, which is the ryanodine receptor. And that opens up a channel for calcium. So calcium then starts to flood through the cytosol, and it can then initiate the cycling of cross bridges between actin and myosin right here. So there are different kinds of receptors in the transverse tubules and sarcoplasmic reticulum compared to the ones that we've looked at already in neurons and in the sarcolemma right here. This is a mechanical receptor. And think of it as, if you want to leave this room and the door is closed, what do you have to do? You physically have to push on the door to open it up, right? And that's exactly what this protein here is doing. It's physically moving, changing a conformation of the ryanodine receptor right here, allowing calcium to leave. Okay. And then as calcium floods the cytosol, there are other receptors, which I don't see on this illustration right here, which are called calcium-induced calcium release channels. So as soon as calcium starts to build up in the cytosol, it changes the conformation in the calcium-induced calcium release channel, so they open up, which does what? It allows more calcium to leave the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So that's a nice positive feedback mechanism, which ensures that there's a huge flood of calcium into the myofibril when there's an action potential traveling down this transverse tubule right here. All right, and then what could you tell me about calcium right here if it's in the myofibril? What's on my next slide? No, same thing, just a little bit. Okay, it binds to troponin. It moves tropomyosin out of the way so that the myosin binding site on actin becomes revealed so that the myosin head group can bind to it. And then if ATP is present, then you can get cross-bridge cycling, and you can get the sliding of myofilaments over each other. All right, so that whole scheme that I just talked about is what we call excitation-contraction coupling. All right, and so you should be aware of all these nifty little proteins that are in the cell membrane underneath the neuromuscular junction, right? You've got the ligand-gated channel, you've got the voltage-gated channel, and in the transverse tubule, you have the DHP receptor and the ryanodine receptor, and what's not shown here are the calcium-induced calcium release channels, which then what just produces this big surge of calcium inside the cell for these filaments to slide over each other, which then causes the muscle to contract. All right, so here is a nice flow diagram. I'm sure this is an exam figure. I don't think the flow diagram is an exam figure. It might be, but I don't think it is. Okay, right here. But here you have an action potential coming down the somatic motor neuron that's going to cause the release of acetylcholine, right? And what ion is necessary within this axon terminus to release acetylcholine? Calcium, again, is the signal, is the cytoplasmic signal. So you're probably getting a pretty good idea of how important calcium is in your body. Okay, and then that acetylcholine binds to the nicotinic receptor right here, right? So that causes depolarization because sodium diffuses in, and that's going to produce threshold voltages at the voltage-gated channels, which produces what? An action potential which travels over the whole sarcoplasmic reticulum, including down into the transverse tubules. Okay, and then that's going to excite the DHP receptors, and the ryanodine receptors are going to be pulled open. That releases calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which then causes even more calcium to be released because there are calcium release channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Well, I can't scroll up or down. All right, but that releases a lot of calcium to bind to troponin, which then allows cross-bridge cycling because tropomyosin is no longer covering up the binding sites on the actin molecule. All right, muscle relaxation. Good, that's the next slide. Muscle relaxation is the reverse of those processes because embedded in the sarcoplasmic reticulum are calcium ATP pumps. Okay, that are always pumping calcium from low concentration to high concentration. That's why it's a pump. From the cytosol back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. They're always operating. And if it's a pump, what does it need? It needs ATP as well, right? So that's why all those mitochondria are in those skeletal muscle cells. And that process kind of wins out when there is not an action potential in the transverse tubule. When the action potential disappears from the transverse tubule, then the calcium pumps kind of win out over the release of calcium through the release channels. And when the calcium concentration decreases within the myofibril, then cross bridges can't form because calcium unbinds from troponin. Tropomyosin covers up the binding sites again, and cross bridges can't form, so muscle is going to relax. And why is it going to relax? Why is it going to stretch back out to its normal position, normal length? Because the cross bridges aren't forming, okay? So actin and myosin aren't going to be able to associate with each other, but why does actin and myosin slide back, though, to its original location? Because of that titin molecule, right, that elastic molecule gets the sarcomere back to its original length, okay? Characteristics of contractions. Let me see if I want to say anything about some of this stuff before we take a break. Yeah, I think I can talk about some of this. Maybe you talked about some of this in lab. Okay. Twitch, right, is just a single rapid contraction of a muscle fiber. Let's just think of one muscle fiber, not a whole muscle, but at least one muscle fiber. And remember, this muscle fiber is going to contract how? Can it contract a little bit, and then at another time, a lot, or all or none response, okay? And it's primarily, the force that's generated is primarily going to be directly related to the amount of free calcium that is surrounding all the myofibrils, right? So when calcium is released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, you can get cross-bridge cycling, and the muscle is going to contract, producing a twitch. And that's what we see on this diagram right here. It's a graph of tension that's being produced by a muscle versus time. right? So it's not a voltage like we looked at for an action potential, but it is, and you might want to draw it in. I don't think your book has it drawn in. It's tension versus time. So when a muscle contracts, it produces tension. And it shortens a little bit as well. Okay. So we see that if we come along with a muscle and stimulate it very rapidly in succession in time, very close to each other, that the first contraction is a little bit weaker compared to the second contraction right here. But what did we say about a muscle contraction? It's an all or none response, right? So if this was an action potential, the amplitude or the peak tension would be exactly the same. All right, so how can we explain summation within one muscle fiber right here? Okay, because what happens is if we stimulate the muscle a second time before it relaxes completely, right, what is the state around the myofibrils in terms of calcium? Yeah, there's still a little residual calcium left in the myofibril causing a little bit of contraction. So to begin with, there is more calcium around the myofibril when it's stimulated a second time so that it produces a stronger contraction because there is some calcium that hasn't been pumped back all completely into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so depending on the frequency of contraction, we can get a graded contraction from a simple muscle fiber, and we explain that by thinking about how much calcium is left over in the cytosol before the next contraction comes along. Okay, and that can produce, right, something over here that we call incomplete tetanus. So here we have a muscle fiber, and we stimulate it to contract, and then in a very short time after that, we stimulate it again, and there is summation between the first and second stimulation right here, which produces a second contraction, which is a little bit stronger. Right, and then we come along again and stimulate the muscle before all the calcium can be pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, so that produces a third contraction, which is a little bit stronger compared to the second, compared to the first, right? And we just continue on with that process until it kind of reaches a little plateau region right here, but there's still partial relaxation between the individual stimuli that we applied. But this plateau right here with this variation is what we call incomplete tetanus. Tetanus would be when a muscle contracts and doesn't relax at all. And we have, what, incomplete tetanus occurring at this point in time right here. All right, and if we come along with shocks that are more frequent in time, 10 shocks per second as opposed to 5 shocks per second, then there's even less time for relaxation and there's even more buildup of calcium within the myofibrils. Right, so that reaches incomplete tetanus quicker, and this is a little bit higher amplitude. But there is still a little bit of relaxation occurring in this muscle. But now if we increase the excitation, the electrical stimulation, much more quickly, up to 60 shocks per second, okay, notice that the muscle goes into complete tetanus. It cannot relax at all because those calcium channels are completely open all the time. So the calcium pumps cannot overcome that, so there is cross-bridge cycling taking place throughout the whole myofibril right here, and that produces a nice plateau region. We call this complete tetanus. And then after a certain period of time, guess what? The tension starts to decrease. Even though we're still providing stimulus to the muscle, we're still shocking the muscle, right? The muscle starts to lose tension. It starts to fatigue. And what could be the reason for that fatigue? Okay, the reason for that fatigue is not because of the neuromuscular junction. Neuromuscular junction is not running out of acetylcholine, okay, because we're not using the neuromuscular junction to stimulate the muscle. But what is happening right here is that, okay, when a muscle is contracting, for instance, blood can't get to it, which means oxygen is not being delivered to those tissues. So what organelle gets a little ornery when that happens? The mitochondria, right, it stops producing ATP. So this fatigue right here is a result of, could be due to a couple things. The decreased concentration of ATP inside the cell, and as ATP decreases, there's another compound, a couple other compounds that build up. But directly, when ATP is hydrolyzed, what compound builds up? Okay, we're going to get to that in a second, but specifically what I'm thinking of is ADP is building up inside the cell. And as ADP builds up inside the cell, the energy content of ATP actually reduces a little bit. Okay. You also have inorganic phosphate building up. That reduces the energy content of ATP a little bit. And the other thing that happens is that lactic acid builds up, which means what happens to the pH of this muscle cell when it's in complete tetanus? The pH changes. And what can you tell me about enzymes with pH? The activity of enzymes are very sensitive to pH, and we were just looking at that ATPase on the myosin head group, right? So the enzyme activity of all these enzymes inside the cell changes, and the myofibrils can't produce the same kind of tension due to decreases in pH, decreases in ATP concentration, increases in ADP and inorganic phosphate, and that produces a real physical fatigue, and a muscle can't contract quite as strongly. We're just a little bit over time. All right, so that's what we call physical fatigue. If you can think of psychological fatigue, somebody can maybe answer that question when we start up on Thursday. What is psychological fatigue of a muscle as opposed to physical, real fatigue? Okay. You're going to say, that's no fair. This is not a psychology class. Okay, sign-in sheet is going around someplace.